Blog Talk Radio. I believe I touched upon this in the last. I ended it with this paragraph, but let me go on. I'll begin with this one now. He talks about, O youthful benefactress, how often in succeeding years, standing in solitary places and thinking of thee with grief of heart and perfect love, how often have I wished that, as in ancient times, the curse of a father was believed to have a supernatural power, and to pursue its object with a fatal necessity of self-fulfillment. Even so, the benediction of a heart oppressed with gratitude might have, like a prerogative, might have power given to it from above to chase, to haunt, or to waylay, to overtake, to pursue thee into the central darkness of a London brothel, or, if it were possible, into the darkness of the grave, there to awaken thee with an authentic message of peace and forgiveness and a final reconciliation. This he was talking about the girl who saved his life. I do not often weep, for not only do my thoughts on subjects connected with the chief interests of man daily, nay hourly, descend a thousand fathoms too deep for tears, not only does the sternness of my habits of thought present an antagonism to the feelings that prompt tears, wanting of necessity to those who, being protected, usually by their levity, from any tendency to mediative sorrow, would by that same levity be made incapable of resisting it on any casual access of such feelings. But also I believe that all minds which have contemplated such objects as deeply as I have done must, for their own protection from utter despondency, have early encouraged and cherished some tranquilizing belief as to the future balances and hieroglyphic meanings of human suffering. On these accounts, I am cheerful to this hour, and as I have said, I do not often weep. Yet some feelings, though not deeper or more passionate or more tender than others, and often when I walk at this hour, and as I have said, and when I walk at this time in Oxford Street, by dreamy lamplight, and hear those airs played on a barrel organ that years ago solaced me with my dear companion, as I must always call her, I shed tears and muse with myself at the mysterious dispensation which so suddenly and so critically separated us forever. How it happened, the reader will understand from what remains of this introductory narration. Soon after the period of the last incident I had recorded, I met in Albemarle Street a gentleman of His Late Majesty's household. The gentleman was received hospitalities on different occasions from my family, and he challenged me upon the strength of my family likeness. I did not attempt any disguise. I answered his question ingenuously, and on his pledging his word of honor that he would not betray me to my guardians, I gave him an address to my friend, the attorneys. The next day I received from him a 10-pound banknote. The letter enclosed it was delivered with other letters of business to the attorney, but though his look and manner informed me that he suspected its contents, he gave it up to me honorably and without demur. This present from the particular service to which it was applied leads me naturally to speak of the purpose that had allured me up to London, and which I had been, to use a forensic word, soliciting from the first day of my arrival in London to that of my final departure. In so mighty a world as London, it will surprise my readers that I should not have found some means of starving off the last extremities of penury. And it will strike them that no resources, at least, must have been open to me, either to seek assistance from the friends of my family or to turn my youthful talents and attainments into some channel of pecuniary emolument. As to the first course, I may observe generally that what I dread beyond all other evils was the chance of being reclaimed by my guardians, not doubting that whatever power that the law gave me would have been enforced against me to the utmost, that is, to the extremity of forcibly restoring me to the school which I had quit, and a restoration which as it would, in my eyes, have been a dishonor, even if submitted to voluntarily, could not fail when extorted from me in contempt and defiance of my own wishes and efforts to have been a humiliation worse to me than death, and which would indeed have terminated a death, which would have terminated in death. I was therefore shy enough of applying for assistance even in those quarters where I was sure of receiving it, at the risk of furnishing my guardians with any clue of recovering me. But as to London in particular, though doubtless my father had in his lifetime had many friends there, yet as 10 years had passed since his death, I remembered few of them, even by name, and never having been in London before, except once for a few hours, I knew not the address of even those few. To this mode of gaining help, therefore, in part the difficulty, but much more the paramount fear which I had mentioned habitually indisposed me. In regard to the other mode, I now feel half inclined to join my reader in wondering what I should have overlooked it. As a corrector of Greek proofs, if in no other way, I might doubtless have gained enough for my slender wants, but in an office as this I could have discharged with an exemplary and punctual accuracy that would soon have gained me the confidence of my employers. But it might not be forgotten that, or rather it must not be forgotten, that even for such an office as this, it was necessary that I should have, of all, have an introduction to some respectable publisher, and this I had no means of obtaining. To say the truth, however, it had never once occurred to me to think of literary labors as a source of profit. No mode sufficiently speedy of obtaining money had ever occurred to me but that of borrowing it for, on the strength of my future claims and expectations. This mode I sought by every avenue to compass, and amongst other persons I applied to a Jew named D. To this Jew, and to other advertising money lenders, some of whom were, I believe, also Jews, I had introduced myself with an account of my expectations, which account, on examining my father's will at Doctors' Commons, they had ascertained to be correct. The person there mentioned as the second son of was found to have all the claims of more than all that I had stated. But one question still remained, with the faces of the Jews pretty significantly suggested, was I that person? The doubt had never occurred to me as a possible one. I had rather feared, whenever my Jewish friends scrutinized me keenly, that I might be too well known to be that person, and that some scheme might be passing in their minds for entrapping me and selling me to my guardians. It was strange to me to find my own self material litter. Consider. So I expressed it, for I doted on logical accuracy of distinctions. Accused, or at least suspected, of counterfeiting my own self formulator, consider. However, to satisfy their scruples, I took the only course in my power. Whilst I was in Wales, I had received various letters from young friends. These I produced, for I carried them constantly in my pocket, being indeed, by this time, almost the only relics of my personal encumbrances, excepting the clothes I wore, which I had not in one way or other disposed of. Most of these letters were from the Earl of, and he keeps this blank, he doesn't state, it's from the Earl of blank, who was at that time my chief, or rather only confidential friend. These letters were dated from Eton. I had also some from the Marquis of blank again, his father, who, though absorbed in agricultural pursuits, yet having been an Etonian himself and a good, as good a scholar as a nobleman needs to be, still retained an affection for classical studies and for youthful scholars. He had accordingly, from the time that I was 15, corresponded with me, sometimes upon the great improvements which he had made for or was meditating in the countries of M and SL since I had been there, and sometimes upon the merits of a Latin poet, and at other times suggesting subjects to me on which he wished me to write verses. I'm going to finish this part, and then we will go into what is officially part two of this story. He says, I'm reading the letters. One of my Jewish friends agreed to furnish me with £200 or £300 on my personal security, provided I could persuade the young Earl, who was, by the way, no older than I was, than myself, to guarantee the payment on our coming of age. The Jew's final object being, as I now suppose, not the trifling profit he could expect to make by me, but the prospect of establishing a connection with my noble friend, whose immense expectations were well known to him. In pursuance of this proposal on the part of the Jew, about 8 or 9 days after I had received the £10, I prepared to go down to Eton. Nearly £3 of the money I had been given nearly £3 of the money I had given to my money-lending friend on his alleging that the stamps must be bought in order that the writings must be preparing whilst I was away from London. I thought in my heart that he was lying, but I did not wish to give him any excuse for charging his own delays upon me. A smaller sum I had given to my friend, the attorney, who was connected with the money lenders as their lawyer, to which indeed he was entitled to his unfurnished lodgings. About 15 shillings I had employed in reestablishing, though in a very humble way, my dress. On the remainder, I gave 1/4 to Anne, meaning on my return to have divided with her whatever might remain. Anne was the girl who saved Slick. The arrangements made soon after 6 o'clock on a dark winter evening, I set off, accompanied by Anne, toward Piccadilly, where it was my intention to go down as far as Sathill, up on the Bath or Bristol Mall. Our course lay through a part of the town which was now all disappeared, so that I can no longer retrace its ancient boundaries. Swallow Street, I think it was called. Having time enough before us, however, we bore away to the left until we came into Golden Square, where there, near the corner of Sharrod Street, we sat down, not wishing to part in the tumult and blaze of Piccadilly. I had told her of my plans some time before, and I now assured her again that she should share my good fortune, if I met with any, and that I would never forsake her as soon as I had power to protect her. This I fully intended, as much from inclination as from a sense of duty, for setting aside gratitude, which in any case might have made me her debtor for life. I loved her as affectionately as if she had been my sister, and at this moment, with sevenfold tenderness, from pity at witnessing her extreme dejection. I had apparently most reason of dejection, because I was leaving the savior of my life. Yet I considering the shock my health had received, was cheerful and full of hope. She, on the contrary, who was parting with one who had had little means of serving her, except by kindness and brotherly treatment, was overcome by sorrow, so that when I kissed her at our final farewell, she put her arms around my neck and wept without speaking a word. I hoped to return in a week at farthest, and I agreed with her that on the fifth night from that, and every night afterwards, she would wait for me at 6 o'clock near the bottom of Great Titchfield Street, which had been our customary haven, as it were, of rendezvous, to prevent our missing each other in the great Mediterranean of Oxford Street. This and other measures of precaution I took, one only I forgot, and she had either never told me, or, as a matter of no great interest, had forgotten her surname. It is a general practice, indeed, of girls of humble rank, in their unhappy condition, not as novel-reading women of higher pretensions, to style themselves Miss Douglas, Miss Montaigne, etc., and simply by their Christian names, Mary, Jane, Frances, etc. Her surname and the surest means of tracing her thereafter, I thought, I ought know now to have inquired, but the truth is, having no reason to think that our meeting could in consequence of a short interruption, be more difficult or uncertain than it had been for so many weeks, I had scarcely for a moment adverted to it as necessary, or placed it among my memoranda against this parting interview. And my final anxieties being spent in confronting her with hopes and impressing upon her the necessity of getting some medicines for a violent cough and hoarseness with which she was troubled, I wholly forgot it until it was too late to recall her. It was past 8 o'clock when I reached the Gloucester Coffee House and the Bristol Mall, the Bristol Mail being on the point of going off, I mounted on the outside. The fine, fluent motion of this mail soon laid me asleep. It is somewhat remarkable that the first easy or refreshing sleep which I had enjoyed for some months was on the outside of a mail coach, a bed which at this day I find rather an uneasy one. Connected with this sleep as a little incident which served, as hundreds of others did at that time, to convince me how easy a man who had never been in any great distress had passed through life without knowing, in his own person at least, anything of the possible goodness of the human heart, or, as I must add with a sigh, of its possible violence. So thick a curtain of manners is drawn over the features and expressions of men's natures, that to the ordinary observer the two extremities and the infinite few of the varieties which lie between them are all confounded. The vast and multitudinous compass of their several harmonies, reduced to the meager online of differences expressed in the gamut of or alphabet of elementary sounds. The case was this: for the first hour, for the first 4 or 5 miles from London, I annoyed my fellow passenger on the roof by occasionally falling against him when the coach gave a lurch to his side, and indeed if the road had been less smooth and level than it is, I should have fallen off from weakness. Of this annoyance he complained heavily, as perhaps in the same circumstances most people would. He expressed his complaint, however, more morosely than the occasion seemed to warrant. And if I had parted with him at that moment, I would have thought of him, if I had considered it worthwhile to think of him at all, as a surly and almost brutal fellow. However, I was conscious that I had given him some cause for complaint, and therefore I apologized to him and assured him I would do what I could to avoid falling asleep for the future. And at the same time, in as few words as possible, I explained to him that I was ill and in a weak state from long suffering, and that I could not afford at that time to take an inside place. This man's manner changed upon hearing this explanation, and in an instant, and when I next woke for a moment from the noise and lights of a Hounslow, for in spite of my wishes and efforts, I had fallen asleep again within 2 minutes from the time I had spoken to him, I found that he had put his arm around me to protect me from falling off. And for the rest of my journey, he behaved to me with the gentlest, with the gentleness of a woman, so that at length I almost lay in his arms. And this was the most kind as he could have known, that I was not going, the whole way to Bath or Bristol. Unfortunately, indeed, I did not go farther than I intended. So, for so genial and so refreshing was my sleep, that the next time after leaving Hounslow, that I fully awoke was upon the sudden pulling up of the mail, possibly at a post office. And on inquiry, I found that we had reached Maidenhead, 6 or 7 miles, I think ahead of Southill. Here I alighted, and for the half minute that the mail stopped, I was entreated by my friendly companion, who, from the transient glimpse I had had of him in Piccadilly, seemed to me to be a gentleman butler or a person of that rank, to go to bed without delay. This I promised, though with no intention of doing so, and in fact I immediately set forward, or rather backward, on foot. It must have been nearly midnight, but so slowly did I creep along that I heard a clock in a cottage strike 4 before I turned down the lane from Slough to Eton. The air and the sleep had both refreshed me, but I was weary nevertheless. I remember a thought, obvious enough, and which has been prettily expressed by a Roman poet, which gave me some consolation at the moment under my poverty. There had been some time before a murder committed on or near Hounslow Heath. I think I cannot be mistaken when I say that the name of the murdered person was Steele, and that he was the owner of a lavender plantation in that neighborhood. Every step of my progress was bringing me nearer to the heath, and it naturally occurred to me that I and the accused murderer, if he were that night abroad, might at every instant be unconsciously approaching each other through the darkness, in which case, said I, supposing I, instead of being, as indeed I am, little better than an outcast, lord of my learning, and no land beside, were like my friend Lord, heir by general repute to £70,000 per annum, what a panic should I be under at this moment without my throat, about my throat. Indeed, it was not likely that Lord Blank should even be in my situation. But nevertheless, the spirit of the remark remained true. The vast power and possessions make a man shamefully afraid of dying, and I am convinced that many of the most intrepid adventurers, who by fortunately being poor, enjoy the full use of their natural courage, would, if at the very instant of going into action the news were brought to them that they had unexpectedly succeeded to an estate in England of £50,000 a year, feel their dislikes to bullets considerably sharpened, and their effort at perfect equanimity and self-possession proportionally difficult. So true is it, in the language of a wise man, whose own experience had made him acquainted with both fortunes, that rich are better fitted to slacken virtue and abate their edge than tempt the herod to do aught may merit praise. That was a quote from Paradise Regained. But I dally with my subject, because to myself, the remembrance of these times is profoundly interesting. But my reader shall not have any further cause to complain, for I now hasten to its close. In the road between Slough and Eton, I fell asleep, and just as the morning began to dawn, I was awakened by the voice of a man standing over me and surveying me. I know not what he was. He was an ill-looking fellow, but not the, therefore of necessity an ill-meaning fellow, for if he were, I suppose he thought that no person sleeping out of doors in winter would be worth robbing. In which conclusion, however, as I regarded myself, I begged to assure him, if he should be among my readers, that he was mistaken. After a slight remark, he passed on, and I was not sorry at his disturbance. And it enabled me to pass through Eton before people were generally awake, or generally up. The night had been heavy and lowering, but towards the morning it had changed to the slight frost, and the ground and the trees were now covered with rime. I slipped through Eton unobserved, washed myself, and as far as possible adjusted my dress as a little public house in Windsor, and about 8 o'clock went down towards Poets. On my road I met some junior boy of whom I made inquiries. An Etonian, as always a gentleman, and in spite of my shabby habiliments, they answered me civilly. My friend Lord Blank was gone to the University of Blank. I had, however, other friends at Eton, but it is not to all that wear this name in prosperity that a man is willing to present himself in distress. On recollecting myself, however, I asked for the Earl of D, to whom, though my acquaintance with him was not so intimate as some others, I should not have shrunk from presenting myself under any circumstances. He was still at Eton, though I believe on the wing for Cambridge. I called, was received kindly, and asked to breakfast. Here let me stop for a moment to check my reader for any erroneous conclusions. Because I have had occasion, incidentally, to speak of various patrician friends, it must be supposed that I have myself any pretension to rank in high blood. I thank God that I have not. I am the son of a plain English merchant, esteemed during his life for his great integrity, and strongly attached to literary pursuits. Indeed, he was himself anonymously an author. If he had lived it was expected that he would have been very rich, but dying prematurely, he left no more than about £30,000 amongst 7 different claimants. My mother, I may mention with honor, as still more highly gifted, for though unpretending to the name and honors of a literary woman, I shall presume to call her what her literary women are not, which is an intellectual woman, and I believe that if ever her letters should be collected and published, they would be thought generally to exhibit as much strong and masculine sense delivered in a pure mother English, racy and fresh with idiomatic graces, as any in our language, and hardly excepting those of Lady M. W. Montaigne. These are my honors of descent. I have no other, and I thank God sincerely that I have not, because in my judgment, a station which raises a man too eminently above the level of his fellow creatures is not the most favorable to moral or to intellectual qualities. Strange to say, however, I could scarce eat anything. On the day when I first received my ten-pound banknote, I had gone to a baker's shop and bought a couple of rolls. Then, this very shop I had 2 months or 6 weeks before surveyed with an eagerness of desire which it was almost humiliating to me to recollect. I remember the story about Otway and feared that there might be danger in eating too rapidly. But I had no need for alarm. My appetite was quite sunk, and I became sick before I had eaten half of what I was of what I had bought. This event from eating, which approached to a meal, I continued to feel for weeks, or when I did not experience any nausea, part of what I ate was rejected, sometimes with acidity, sometimes immediately without any acidity. On the present occasion at Lord D's table, I found myself not at all better than usual, and in the midst of luxuries I had no appetite. I had, however, unfortunately at all times, a craving for wine. I explained my situation, therefore, to Lord D, and gave him a short account of my late sufferings, in which he expressed great compassion and called for wine. This gave me a momentary relief and pleasure, and on all occasions when I had an opportunity, I never failed to drink wine, which I worshipped then, as I have since worshipped opium. I am convinced, however, that this indulgence in wine contributed to strengthen my malady, for the tone of my stomach was apparently quite sunk, and by a better regimen, it might sooner and perhaps eventually have been revived. I hope that it was not from this novel wine that I lingered in the neighbors of my intimate friends. I persuaded myself that it was from reluctance to ask of Lord D, on whom I was conscious I had not sufficient claims, the particular service in quest of which I had come down to Eden. I was, however, unwilling to lose my journey, and I asked that Lord D, whose good nature was unbounded, and which in regard to myself had been measured rather by his compassion and perhaps for my condition and his knowledge of my intimacy with some of his relatives, than by any over rigorous inquiry into the extent of my own direct claims, faltered nevertheless at his request. He acknowledged that he did not like to have any dealings with moneylenders, and feared lest such a transaction might come to the ears of his connections. However, he doubted whether his signature, whose expectations were so much more bounded than those of, would avail with any Christian friends. However, he did not wish, as it seemed, to mortify me by any absolute refusal, for after a little consideration, he promised, under certain conditions, which he pointed out, to give his security. Lord D was at this time not 18 years of age, but I have often doubted, on recollecting since, the good sense and prudence which on this occasion he mingled with so much urbanity of manner, and urbanity which in him wore the grace of youthful sincerity, whether any statesman, the oldest and most accomplished in diplomacy, could have acquitted himself better under the same circumstances. Most people, indeed, cannot be addressed on such a business without surveying you with looks as austere and unperfidious as those of a Saracen's head. I have to stop there because I know I'm probably getting into the language. This was written in 1821, so the grammar is different, and the paragraphs are extremely long, and the sentences are long. But there's no better. I mean, aside from a full modern translation of it, there's no better way to read it. But I hope I haven't lost anybody on this, but it is lengthy, but I'm reluctant to edit this great masterpiece. And the reason is because I read it in this language early on, and I was 18. But it was an abridged version of it, I have to say. But at the same time,
if indeed they had any to give.
And finally, as my despairing resource, on the day I left London, I put into the hands of the only person who I was sure must know Anne by sight, from having been in company with us once or twice, an address to in Shire, at that time the residence of my family. But to this hour I have never heard a syllable about her. This moment, this amongst such troubles as most men meet with in this life, have been my heaviest affliction. If she lived, doubtless we must have been some time in search for each other. At the very same moment, though, the mighty labyrinths of London, perhaps even between a few feet of each other, a barrier no wider than a London street, often amounting in the end of a separation for eternity. And during some years I hoped that she did live, and I suppose that in the literal and unrhetorical use of the word myriad, I may say that on my different visits to London I have looked into many, many myriads of female faces in the hope of meeting her. I should know her again amongst a thousand if I saw her for a moment, for though not handsome, she had a sweet expression of countenance and a peculiar and graceful carriage of the head. I sought her, I have said, in hope. So it was for years, but now I should fear to see her, and her cough, which grieved me when I parted with her, is now my consolation. I now wish to see her no longer, but think of her more, gladly, as one long since laid in the grave, I would hope of a Magdalen taken away before injuries and cruelty had blotted out and transfigured her ingenuous nature, of the brutalities of ruffians had completed the ruin they had begun. And this is part, this is the official part two. So then, Oxford Street, stony-hearted stepmother, thou that listenest to the sights of orphans and drinkest the tears of children, at length I was dismissed from thee. The time was come at last that I no more should pace in anguish thy never-ending terraces, no more should dream and wake in captivity to the pangs of hunger. Successors too many, to myself and Anne, have doubtless since then trodden in our footsteps, inheritors of our calamities. Other orphans than Anne have sighed, tears have been shed by other children, and thou, Oxford Street, hast since doubtless echoed to the groans of enumerated hearts. For myself, however, the storm which I had outlived seemed to have been the pledge of a long, fair weather. The premature sufferings which I had paid down to have been accepted as a ransom for my many years to come, as a price of long immunity from sorrow. And if again I walked in London a solitary and contemplative man, as often I did, I walked for the most part in serenity and peace of mind. And although it is true that the calamities of my novitiate in London had struck root so deep in my bodily constitution that afterwards they shot up and flourished afresh and grew into a noxious umbrage that has overshadowed and darkened my latter years, yet these second assaults of suffering were met with a fortitude more confirmed with the resources of a mature intellect and with the alleviations from sympathizing affection, how deep and tender. Thus, however, whatsoever alleviations, years that were far asunder were bound together by subtle links of suffering derived from a common root. And herein I noticed an instant of the short-sightedness of human desires, that oftentimes on moonlight nights, during my first mournful abode in London, my consolation was, if such it could be thought, to gaze from Oxford Street up every avenue in succession, which pierces through the heart of Marrowbone to the fields and in the woods. For that said, I traveling with my eyes up the long vistas, which lay part in light and part in shade. That is the road to the north, and therefore too, and if I had the wings of a dove, that way I would fly for comfort. Thus I said, and thus I wished in my blindness. Yet even in that very northern region it was, even in that very valley, nay, in that very house to which my erroneous wishes pointed, that this second birth of my sufferings began, and that they again threatened to besiege the citadel of life and hope. There it was that for years I was persecuted by visions as ugly and as ghastly phantoms as ever haunted the couch of an Orestes, and in this unhappier than he that sleep, such which comes to all as a respite and restoration, and to him especially as a blessed balm for his wounded heart and his haunted brain, visited me by my bitterest scourge. Thus blind was I in my desires. Yet if a veil interposes between the dim-sightedness of man and his future calamities, the same veil hides from him their alleviations. And a grief which had not been feared is met by consolations which had not been hoped. I therefore, who participated, as it were, in the troubles of Orestes, excepting only in his agitated conscience, precipitated no less in all his supports. My Eumenides, like his, were at my bed feet and stared in upon me through the curtains, but watching by my pillow, or defrauding herself of sleep to bear me company through the heavy watches of the night, set my Electra, for thou, beloved M, dear companion of my later years, thou was my Electra, and neither in nobility of mind nor in long-suffering affections would permit her that a Grecian sister should excel an English wife. For thou thoughtest not much to stoop to humble offices of kindness and to servile ministrations of tenderest affection, to wipe away for years the unwholesome dews upon the forehead, or to refresh the lips which parched and baked with fever, nor even when thy own peaceful slumbers had by long sympathy been infected with the spectacle of my dread constant with phantoms and shadowy enemies that oftentimes bade me sleep no more. Not even then did thou utter a complaint or any murmur, nor withdraw thy angelic smiles, nor shrink from thy service of love. More than Electra did of old, for she too, though she was a Grecian woman and the daughter of the king of men, yet wept sometimes and hid her face in a robe. But these troubles are past, and thou wilt read records of a period so dolorous to us both as the legend of some hideous dream that can return no more. Meantime, I am again in London, and again I pace the terraces of Oxford Street at night, and oftentimes, when I am oppressed by anxieties that demand all my philosophy and all the comfort of thy presence to support, and yet remember that I am separated from thee by the 300 miles and a length of 3 dreary months, I look up the streets that run run northward from Oxford Street upon moonlit nights, and recollect my youthful ejaculations of anguish, and remembering that thou art sitting alone in that same valley, and mistress of that very house to which my heart turned in its blindness 19 years ago, I think that, though blind indeed, and scattered to the winds of late, the promptings of my heart may yet have had reference to the remoter time, and may be justified if read in another meaning, and if I could allow myself to descend again to the impotent wishes of childhood, I could again say to myself, as I looked to the north, oh, that I had the wings of a dove, and with how just a confidence in thy good and gracious nature might I add the other half of my early ejaculation, and that way I would fly for comfort. The pleasures of opium. It is so long since I first took opium that if it had been a trifling incident in my life, I might have forgotten its state. But cardinal events are not to be forgotten, and from circumstances connected with it, I remember that it must be referred to the autumn of 1804. And during the season, I was in London, having come thither to the first time since my entrance at college. And my introduction to opium arose in the following way. From an early age, I had been accustomed to wash my head in cold water at least once a day, and being suddenly seized with a toothache, I attributed it to some relaxation caused by an accidental intermission of that practice, jumped out of bed, plunged my head into a basin of cold water, and with the hair thus wetted, went to sleep. The next morning, as I needed to hardly say, I woke with excruciating rheumatic pains of the head and face, from which I had hardly any respite for about 20 days. And on the 21st day, I think it was, and on a Sunday, that I went out into the streets rather to run away, if possible, from my torments than with any distinct purpose. By accident, I met a colleague acquaintance who recommended opium. Opium, dread agent of unimaginable pleasure and pain. I had heard of it as I had a mania, had of manna and ambrosia, but no further. How unmeaning a sound was it at that time? What solemn chords does it now strike upon my heart? What heart-quaking vibrations of sad and happy remembrances? Reverting for a moment to thee, I feel a mystic importance attached to the minutest circumstances connected with the place and the time and the man, if man he was, that first laid open to me the paradise of opium eaters. It was a Sunday afternoon, wet and cheerless, and a duller spectacle this earth of ours had not to show than a rainy Sunday in London. My road homeward lay toward Oxford Street, and near the stately Pantheon, as Mr. Wordsworth had obligingly called it, I saw a druggist's shop. The druggist, unconscious minister of the celestial pleasures, as if in sympathy with a rainy Sunday, looked dull and stupid, but as in any mortal druggist might be expected to look on a Sunday, and with an ask, and when I asked for the tincture of opium, he gave it to me as any other man might do, and furthermore, out of my shilling returned me with what seemed to be a real copper halfpence taken out of a real wooden drawer. And nevertheless, in spite of such indications of humanity, he has ever since existed in my mind as the beatific vision of an immortal druggist sent down to earth on a special mission to myself. And it confirms me in this way of considering him that when I next came up to London, I sought him near the State Pantheon and found him not. And thus to me, who knew not his name, if indeed he had one, he seemed rather to have vanished from Oxford Street than to have removed in any bodily fashion. The reader may choose to think of him as possibly no more than a sublunary druggist. It may be so, but my faith is better. I believe him to have evanesced or evaporated. So unwillingly would I connect my immortal remembrances with that hour and place and creature that first brought me acquainted with the celestial drug. I want to stop there. It's the show is already finished, and we'll start there next week when he the first time he does opium, and on this section that's called The Pleasures of Opium. And I'm looking forward to reading this to you next time. But in the second part, if we get to it next week, we call the, I'm hoping that we will. I think we got The Pleasures of Opium. And the second part of this is called The Introduction to the Pains of Opium and what occurred then. So we'll go from there. But I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please tell your friends. And if you want to easily get these programs, I have them on my website, lasteelshow.org. You can just go to that and go into the audio section on the menu, and these will come up. I'll be posting this one later this evening or tomorrow morning on my website, and it's part 1, 2, and 3, and you'll see them. So I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for listening to me, and I'll talk to you next week. Join us Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night. For those of you who have followed me all along, I'm hoping that we'll be able to revise our Friday night program. I haven't yet decided what format. I'm trying to establish some guests and possibly a regular guest on the program, but we haven't come to any terms yet. So with that, we'll keep that up in the air, and hopefully by the end of August, we'll be doing our end of August, beginning of September, we may be able to continue our Friday night programs again. So in the meantime, I thank you, and I hope you enjoyed the show. And tune in next Thursday for part 4, okay, of our reading of The Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And that part will be The Pleasures of Opium. So we'll talk to you then. Good night.